Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 955. Syrian chemical attack, not so fast, part two. This is being recorded on April 20th of the year 2017. In this program, we are going to further develop analysis that is receiving a certain amount of distribution, but not as much as I think it deserves. That analysis being done by Theodore Postol, or Postol, P-O-S-T-O-L, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He has done a review of the, quote, evidence, unquote, that has been presented in defense of the Trump administration's decision to launch a bunch of cruise missiles at an airbase in Syria. We have discussed that and some of the issues factoring into that overall event in For the Record 954, and we're going to further develop that analysis here. In addition to that, we are going to present some perspective on at least some of the meetings that were, some of the networking that was taking place between people who were either part of or apparently representing the incoming Trump administration and people linked to Vladimir Putin of Russia. In numerous programs, For the Record 917, 923, 924, 943, and others, we have talked about the high-profile hacks and the certainty that the author of those attacks, whoever it may have been, was it sure as hell wasn't the Russian intelligence service. And in fact, the hacks may very well not have been hacks at all, but insider downloading of information onto a flash drive. It remains to be seen exactly who did that, but the evidence points in connection with the steady drip, drip, drip of information presented by WikiLeaks during the campaign, and WikiLeaks having been in touch with Roger Stone, the veteran GOP dirty tricks expert, who was functioning in that capacity for the Trump campaign. The evidence points in the direction of the far right and the Trump administration, those two things being inextricably linked. However, we're going to be talking about the sarin attack and some backdoor negotiations apparently conducted on behalf of the incoming Trump administration by none other than Eric Prince. Eric Prince was the founder of Blackwater. His successor as head of Blackwater, Joseph E. Schmitz, was another key Trump national security advisor during the campaign. And Eric Prince was apparently functioning as a backdoor channel, courtesy of the United Arab Emirates, that networking taking place with Russian officials, the goal being, however, not to affect a new detente between Russia and the Trump administration and some of the, frankly, the pipe dreams that existed in certain quarters that the Trump administration was going to represent a step away from wars of regime change and the new Cold War, etc. I voiced my opinion in For the Record 918 and 919. That, in fact, the benign statements by the Trump administration vis-a-vis Russia were, in fact, intended to open up a bidding war between Russia and the West that would ultimately benefit Germany. We'll see how that plays out. But the notion that the Trump administration was somehow going to represent something of the, or manifest a peace agenda, or at the very least a more benign approach to foreign policy, struck me as frankly delusional. If there was ever a personality who could be described as belligerent and superficially so, it is Donald Trump. And if there was ever a personality suited to being manipulated vis-a-vis provocation, it is Donald Trump. We're also going to conclude with some discussion of what Trump or his administration, perhaps even his administration minus Donald Trump, if he were ever removed in favor of Mike Pence, the guy I really think the Republican Party wants more than they like Trump, and who appears to be someone making many of the key decisions behind the scenes in this administration. We're going to conclude by taking a look at what might happen in the event of another large domestic terrorist incident or incidents, or at least something that is amplified by the right-wing amen media chorus to look like another large attack, whether it is on the scale of September 11th or larger, or simply something that can be played by the media. We're going to take a look at how that in turn might benefit Trump's political hand or the hand of his successors. And some of my ruminations vis-a-vis the destructive policies undertaken by Bernie Sanders in terms of incorporating people like Keith Ellison into positions of leadership in the Democratic Party should be seen against some of the ruminations at the end of this program, and also the shock to the system that has been forecast and to an extent endorsed by the likes of Steve Bannon and company. Taking a look at how Trump behaved and how his administration reacted, and beyond that, how the media reacted in connection with the Syrian chemical weapons attack, or alleged chemical weapons attack, as it appears to have been, this should inform us about events that may manifest down the line. One of the few media voices to give some serious play to debunking of the administration's claims that Mr. Assad launched, basically decided to smash himself in the face with a strategic cream pie and launch a chemical weapons attack on an Al-Qaeda stronghold in Syria, thereby doing exactly what the opposition wanted him to do. One of the very few media voices open to alternative analysis has been the Consortium News website. And on April 14th of 2017, they featured yet more analysis by Robert Perry, the editor of that website. Did Al-Qaeda fool the White House again? And the excerpt of this article that I'm going to read discusses the analysis, or presents the analysis, of Theodore Postol, or Postol, P-O-S-T-O-L, at some length. Skipping down. With the U.S. intelligence community effectively silenced by the fact that the president has already acted, Theodore Postol, a technology and national security expert at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, undertook his own review of the supposed evidence cited by Trump's White House to issue a four-page intelligence assessment on April 11th, asserting with high confidence, unquote, that Assad's military delivered a bomb filled with sarin on the town of Khan Sheikhoun on the morning of April 4th. Postol, whose analytical work helped debunk official Washington's groupthink regarding the 2013 sarin attack outside Damascus, expressed new shock at the shoddiness of the latest White House report, or WHR. Postol produced, quote, a quick turnaround assessment, unquote, of the April 11th report that night, and went into greater detail in an addendum on April 13th, writing, quote, this addendum provides data that unambiguously shows that the assumption in the White House report that there was no tampering with the alleged site of the sarin release is not correct. This egregious error raises questions about every other claim contained in the White House report. The implication of this observation is clear. The White House report was not reviewed and released by any competent intelligence expert unless they were motivated by factors other than concerns about the accuracy of the report. This last sentence again. The implication of this observation is clear. The White House report was not reviewed and released by any competent intelligence expert unless they were motivated by factors other than concerns about the accuracy of the report. The White House report also makes claims about communications intercepts, unquote, which supposedly provide high confidence that the Syrian government was the source of the attack. There is no reason to believe that the veracity of this claim is any different from the now verified false claim that there was unambiguous evidence of a sarin release at the cited crater. The evidence that unambiguously shows that the assumption postal notes, that the assumption that the sarin release crater was tampered with is contained in 6 photographs at the end of this document. One more time. The evidence that unambiguously shows that the assumption that the sarin release crater was tampered with is contained in 6 photographs at the end of this document. The document is linked. Postal notes that one key photo, quote, shows a man standing in the alleged sarin release crater. He is wearing a honeycomb face mask that is designed to filter small particles from the air. Other apparel on him is an open-necked cloth shirt and what appear to be medical exam gloves. Two other men are standing in front of him on the left in the photograph, also wearing honeycomb face masks and medical exam gloves. If there were any sarin present at this location where this photograph was taken, everybody in that photograph would have received a lethal or debilitating dose of sarin. The fact that these people were dressed so inadequately either suggests a complete ignorance of the basic measures needed to protect an individual from sarin poisoning, or that they knew that the site was not seriously contaminated by sarin. This is the crater that is the centerpiece evidence provided in the White House report for a sarin attack delivered by a Syrian aircraft. After reviewing other discrepancies in photos of the crater, Postal wrote, quote, it is hard for me to believe that anybody competent could have been involved in producing the White House report, and the implications of such an obviously predetermined result strongly suggests that this report was not motivated by a serious analysis of any kind. This finding is disturbing, Postal writes. It indicates that the White House report was probably a report purely aimed at justifying actions that were not supported by any legitimate intelligence. This is not a unique situation. President George W. Bush has argued that he was misinformed about unambiguous evidence that Iraq was hiding a substantial amount of weapons of mass destruction. This false intelligence led to a U.S. attack on Iraq that started a process that ultimately led to a political disintegration in the Middle East, which, through a series of unpredicted events, then led to the rise of the Islamic State. By the way, I wouldn't characterize that as unpredicted events. Actually, in the book The Name of Osama Bin Laden by Roland Jacquin, we talked about the doomsday contingency arrangement between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Al-Qaeda, in which if Saddam Hussein was taken out of the box, collaboration on communicating information about chemical and biological warfare would be undertaken. We've also noted that much of the military prowess that ISIS manifests derives from the fact that many of its key officers were commissioned officers in Saddam Hussein's military, and they have basically translated their military experience into their service with ISIS. Continuing, Health Postal's analysis, on August 30, 2013, the White House under President Obama produced a similarly false report about the nerve agent attack on August 21, 2013 in Damascus. This report also contained numerous intelligence claims that could not be true. An interview with President Obama published in The Atlantic in April of 2016 indicates that Obama was initially told that there was solid intelligence that the Syrian government was responsible for the nerve agent attack of August 21st of 2013 in Ghouta, Syria. Obama reported that he was later told that the intelligence was not solid by the then Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. Quote, equally serious questions are raised about the abuse of intelligence findings by the incident in 2013. Questions that could not have been answered about that incident is how the White House produced a false intelligence report with false claims that could obviously be identified by experts outside the White House and without access to classified information. There also needs to be an explanation of why this 2013 false report was not corrected. It is now obvious that a second incident similar to what happened in the Obama administration has now occurred in the Trump administration. In this case, the president, supported by his staff, made a decision to launch 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase. This action was accompanied by serious risks of creating a confrontation with Russia and also undermining cooperative efforts to win the war against the Islamic State. I therefore conclude that there needs to be a comprehensive investigation of these events that have either misled people in the White House or, worse yet, been perpetrated by people seeking to force decisions that were not justified by the cited intelligence. This is a serious matter and should not be allowed to continue. That again, Theodore Postol, or Postol, P-O-S-T-O-L, an expert at MIT, and presented at greater detail in yet another article by Robert Perry on the Consortium News website.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Another of the alleged chemical weapons attacks by Bashar al-Assad were some uses of chlorine gas, although these alleged Assad attacks were far less lethal. And in another article on the Consortium News website, Robert Perry talks about the chlorine gas cases as well. This from April 6th of 2017. New York Times retreats on 2013 Syria sarin gas claims. Skipping down and talking about the alleged chlorine gas attacks by the Assad government. The chlorine gas cases have resulted in only a few fatalities, which also undercuts the claims that the Assad regime was responsible for them. Why would Assad risk more outside military intervention against his government by using a chemical weapon that has almost no military value, at least as allegedly deployed in Syria? UN investigators, under intense pressure from the West to find something that could be pinned on Assad, agreed to blame him for a couple of the chlorine allegations coming from rebel forces and their civilian allies. But the UN team did not inspect the sites directly, relying instead on the testimony of Assad's enemies, parenthetically, as is the case in Idlib. Al-Nusra Front, basically Al-Qaeda in Iraq, operating in Syria, a direct offshoot, a branch of Al-Qaeda, are the primary rebels, unquote, on the ground in this area. Continuing. In one of the chlorine cases, however, Syrian eyewitnesses came forward to testify that the rebels had staged the alleged attack so it could be blamed on the government. In that incident, the UN team reached no conclusion as to what had really happened, but neither did the investigators, now alerted to the rebels' tactic of staging chemical attacks, apply any additional skepticism to the other cases. In one case, the rebels and their supporters also claimed to know that an alleged barrel bomb, unquote, contained a canister of chlorine because of the sound that it made while descending. There was no explanation for how that sort of detection was even possible. Yet, despite the flaws in the rebels' chlorine cases and the collapse of the 2013 sarin case, the New York Times and other mainstream U.S. news outlets report the chlorine allegations as flat fact, without reference to sourcing from U.N. investigators whose careers largely depended on them coming up with conclusions that pleased the majority of the five-member Security Council, the U.S., Great Britain, and France. If this fuller history were understood, much greater skepticism would be warranted by the new allegations about Assad ordering a new sarin attack. While it's conceivable that Assad's military is guilty, although why Assad would take this risk at this moment is hard to fathom, it's also conceivable that Al-Qaeda's jihadists, finding themselves facing impending defeat, chose to stage a sarin attack even if that meant killing some innocent civilians. Al-Qaeda's goal would be to draw in the U.S. or Israeli military against the Syrian government, creating space for a jihadist counteroffensive. And, as we should all recall, it's not as if Al-Qaeda hasn't killed many innocent civilians before. Another interesting detail about the sarin incident, or alleged sarin incident, and that concerns the relatively widespread publicity of a doctor who was treating the alleged chemical weapons victims. Turns out he himself has a jihadist background. From the International Business Times of April 7th of 2017, article by Tarek, T-A-R-E-Q, Haddad, H-A-D-D-A-B, British doctor who documented Syria, quote, chemical attack, unquote, previously held on terror offenses. A British doctor who documented a suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria was considered a committed jihadist, unquote, by MI6, and was struck off the General Medical Council in 2016. Shajul, S-H-A-J-U-L, Islam, I-S-L-A-M, 31, posted several videos on Twitter in the aftermath of the Tuesday, April 4th attack, where he appeared to be treating patients in Khan Sheikhoun. He appeared on several television networks such as NBC to discuss what he saw, but it has now emerged that Islam was previously charged on terror offenses in the UK. Islam, from Stratford in East London, first traveled to Syria in 2012 and worked in opposition-held areas of the country such as Al-Bab, close to the Turkish border. But shortly after arriving, he was wanted by MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Agency, for his alleged role in the kidnapping of British photojournalist John Cantley and his Dutch colleague Jeroen Erlemans. Cantley is C-A-N-T-L-I-E, and J-E-R-O-E-N-O-E-R-L-E-M-A-N-S is the Dutch journalist's name. Cantley and Odermans were held captive for 9 days after they strayed into a jihadist camp in northern Syria where Islam was working. Islam maintains he was simply a medic who was not affiliated to any terror groups, but when he returned to the UK in 2013, he was arrested at Heathrow Airport and held in Sussex Police's Special Counterterrorism Unit, terrorism units. Islam was charged along with his younger brother, Najul Islam, who had worked in the Department of Work and Pensions before traveling to Syria, and Jubair Chaudhuri, Chowdhury. All three were held in the high-security Belmarsh prison until they were charged with terrorism offenses to appear in Kingston Crown Court. That, again, was one of the medical people who received a fair amount of photographic and journalistic coverage in the aftermath of the event. By the way, I know whether or not it is mere coincidence. The attack took place on the 50th anniversary of a famous speech that Dr. Martin Luther King gave, in which he articulated his fundamental opposition, King's, that is, fundamental opposition to the Vietnam War. That was on April 4th, 1967. King was assassinated 1 year to the day after that. Whether or not it was a coincidence or some sort of grim joke on someone's part, the alleged sarin attack in Syria took place on the 50th anniversary of that speech. One of the things that took place in the aftermath of Trump's firing cruise missiles at Syria, in addition to the fact that he received a lot of journalistic and propagandistic glad-handing over his handling of the incident, and in addition to the fact that this cued more calls for regime change in Syria on the part of the usual suspects, the attacks on Syria generated a lot of political capital for Donald Trump in the sense that it laid to rest. It basically neutered the Trump as Putin puppet meme that had achieved an awful lot of propaganda. Again, I simply dismiss, although I have no doubt that the Putin administration wanted to see Trump elected for a variety of reasons, I think not the least of which was that Putin certainly must have known that having Trump as head of state would greatly weaken the U.S. I think China had a very similar view, although because of his statements about China during the campaign, Trump was never portrayed as a Chinese dupe. However, the Chinese are not stupid, and they certainly know that the damage that Trump and company are going to do to the U.S. is going to be enormous and probably irreversible. I do not doubt that there were people in Russia who would have seen Trump as a more beneficial occupant of the White House for Russian interests than Hillary Clinton, although I would remind people that Hillary Clinton's State Department and Barack Obama's State Department authored the Reboot with Russia, and that came to an end with the travels of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, whose world travels ultimately put an end to that and cued the new Cold War. This, in a manner not unlike the way the downing of Francis Gary Powers' U-2 spy plane in May of 1960 helped to deep-six the efforts by then-Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and then-U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower to achieve détente. Ultimately, the downing of that plane was blamed by some observers on none other than Lee Harvey Oswald, and I have noted in many programs that Snowden is, in effect, the obverse Oswald. There certainly was contact between representatives of the Russian government and people acting on behalf of the incoming Trump administration or the campaign. However, as the dust has settled, I think we're gaining a little more insight into the nature of those comments. The older I get and the more time passes, the more things are looking utterly insane to me. I find myself using the adjective surreal to describe so much of what is going on. And people, and there were a lot of them in the so-called progressive sector, including people on some of the news outlets that I frequently feature on this program. Anyone who saw Donald Trump as sort of a moderate influence vis-a-vis foreign policy, or even as a peace candidate, a limited peace candidate, should receive some serious personal care. I think they could single-handedly keep the psych meds industry alive with what it would take to keep their feet on the ground. It would be difficult to imagine someone more belligerent than Donald Trump. And this was really pretty obvious during his campaign. If one moved past some of the superficial rhetoric and looked at some of the people he had advising him. Again, people like Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, who was a sort of behind-the-scenes advisor. Prince's successor, Joseph E. Schmitz, the former inspector general of the military of the Pentagon, was another of them. And no sooner did Trump get into office than he introduced a bill to have a huge increase in military spending and then put generals in key positions with regard to the Pentagon and other government agencies, and basically gave the military a long leash to do whatever they wish to do. So far, this has resulted in an increase in civilian casualties with regard to Pentagon or Pentagon-approved airstrikes. It remains to be seen as what comes of that, whether this ultimately the increased civilian casualties ultimately increases the push by jihadis to gain revenge on the U.S., if that ultimately helps to precipitate a terrorist incident in this country or terrorist incidents remains to be seen. One of the things that's interesting, however, is that at least some of the contact between the Trump administration and representatives of the Russian government, this being brokered by people from the United Arab Emirates. This was aimed at not producing peace, but rather at trying to work out some sort of accommodation between the Trump administration and the Putin government to move away from Iran and Syria in order to enable the U.S. and presumably its allies like Saudi Arabia and Israel to pursue a more aggressive and warlike approach to Iran and Syria, possibly even opening a new, beginning a new war.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
So again, the point being that at least some of the contact between the Trump transition team and the representatives of Russia were not aimed at producing detente or peace, but rather this was a hope on the part of some analysts that ultimately Russia could be brought into alignment with the Trump administration's goals of sticking it ultimately to Iran and to Syria. And again, Blackwater founder Eric Prince, whose sister Betsy DeVos is the Secretary of Education now, he was an apparent behind-the-scenes advisor for the Trump transition team, was a major contributor to Trump's campaign, and has been reported by a number of sources as being a behind-the-scenes national security advisor for Trump. And again, it was Eric Prince who was one of the go-betweens with people from the United Arab Emirates and people from Putin's administration. And the goal was not peace or détente, but rather the goal was to get Russia to stand aside and give the U.S. a free hand in pursuing activities against Iran and Syria. Article about that by Adam Entous, E-N-T-O-U-S, Greg Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, and Kevin Seif, or Seif, S-I-E-F-F, and Karen DeYoung, this from the Washington Post of April 3rd of 2017. Now note that this was reported one day before the alleged Syrian chemical weapons attack. It's titled, Blackwater Founder Held Secret Seychelles Meeting to Establish Trump-Putin-Back Channel. And again, peace, détente, that was not the goal of this at all. And again, this article came out one day before the alleged Syrian chemical weapons attack. The United Arab Emirates arranged a secret meeting in January between Blackwater founder Eric Prince and a Russian close to President Vladimir Putin as part of an apparent effort to establish a back-channel line of communication between Moscow and President-elect Donald Trump, according to U.S., European, and Arab officials. The meeting took place around January 11th, 9 days before Trump's inauguration in the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean, officials said. Though the full agenda remains unclear, the United Arab Emirates agreed to broker the meeting in order to explore whether Russia could be persuaded to curtail its relationship with Iran, including in Syria, a Trump administration objective that would be likely to require major concessions to Moscow on U.S. sanctions. Though Prince had no formal role with the Trump campaign or transition team, he presented himself as an unofficial envoy for Trump to high-ranking Emiratis involved in setting up his meeting with the Putin confidant, according to the officials, who did not identify the Russian. Prince was an avid supporter of Trump. After the Republican convention, he contributed $250,000 to Trump's campaign, the National Party, and a pro-Trump super PAC led by GOP mega-donor Rebecca Mercer, records show. He has ties to people in Trump's circle, including Stephen K. Bannon, now serving as the president's chief strategist and senior counselor. Prince's sister, Betsy DeVos, serves as education secretary in the Trump administration. And Prince was seen in the Trump transition offices in New York in December. U.S. officials said the FBI has been scrutinizing the Seychelles meeting as part of a broader probe of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election and alleged contacts between associates of Putin and Trump. The FBI declined to comment. The Seychelles encounter, which one official said spanned 2 days, adds to an expanding web of connections between Russia and Americans with ties to Trump, skipping down. In an unusual breach of protocol, the UAE did not notify the Obama administration in advance of the visit, though officials found out because Zayed's name appeared on a flight manifest. Officials said Zayed and his brother, the United Arab Emirates National Security Advisor, coordinated the Seychelles meeting with Russian government officials with the goal of establishing an unofficial back channel between Trump and Putin. Officials said Zayed wanted to be helpful to both leaders, who had talked about working more closely together, a policy objective long advocated by the Crown Prince. The UAE, which sees Iran as one of its main enemies, also shared the Trump team's interest in finding ways to drive a wedge between Moscow and Tehran. Zayed met twice with Putin in 2016, according to Western officials, and urged the Russian leader to work more closely with the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, an effort to isolate Iran. At the time of the Seychelles meeting and for weeks afterward, the UAE believed that Prince had the blessing of the new administration to act as its unofficial representative. And indeed, that, I think, is something that we can assume was probably, in fact, the case. Skipping down. Eric Prince has had lucrative contracts with the United Arab Emirates government, which at one point paid his firm a reported $529 million to help bring in foreign fighters to help assemble an internal paramilitary force capable of carrying out secret operations and protecting Emirati installations from terrorist attacks. Skipping down again. Following the New York meeting between the Emiratis and Trump aides, Zayed was approached by Prince, who said he was authorized to act as an unofficial surrogate for the president-elect, according to the officials. He wanted Zayed to set up a meeting with a Putin associate. Zayed agreed and proposed the Seychelles as the meeting place because of the privacy it would afford both sides. He wanted to be helpful, one official said of Zayed. Again, not one day that article came out one day before the alleged Syrian sarin strike that has been the focal point of most of this program and the last program as well. And again, the point being here that the goal, at least of this element of contacts between the Putin and Trump administrations, was not peace at all, but was an attempt to influence Russia to stand back and basically let the U.S. and or its proxies go after Iran and Syria. Something too in, for the record, 953. I was going to do several programs dealing with the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, but there is so much going on that basically I threw most of that out the window and only did one show dealing with some of the ways in which the Sanders machine, the Bernie bots, have paved the way for some enormous political capital to be mined by the Trump and or the GOP, the Trump administration and or the GOP or the right wing in general, with regard to painting the Democratic Party as the terrorist party or the Al-Qaeda party. It's sort of ironic in light of the way in which Al-Qaeda offshoots like the Al-Nusra Front are being utilized as proxy warriors in Syria and elsewhere. But again, in For the Record 953, we talked about ways in which people with links to the Muslim Brotherhood, and in the case of Keith Ellison, the deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee, someone who was heavily promoted by Bernie Sanders. Keith Ellison has one foot in the Muslim Brotherhood and another in the Nation of Islam. And in my considerate opinion, is the very last type of individual the Democrats should even consider as their national face. It would be wrong, by the way, to blame the Democrats and the so-called progressive sector in general's obsession with identity politics on Bernie Sanders, but he has fallen right into that. And with things like proposing that all the Democratic primaries be open primaries, which would basically allow the Republican Party to choose the Democratic nominee, and with things like hyping Keith Ellison to be head of the DNC. He narrowly was defeated. He's now the deputy head of the DNC. And with people like Faisal Gill, this is surreal, Faisal Gill being a Grover Norquist protege, a key official with the Karl Rove Grover Norquist Islamic Free Market Institute, he switched parties and is now head of the Democratic, the Vermont Democratic Party. The stage is set for some more snap judgments and some truly productive political capital to be mined by Donald Trump and or the GOP in the event of another terrorist attack. And some of the people who were worried about this include people like John Yoo and other Bush administration, George W. Bush administration officials. It was John Yoo who wrote the legal opinion permitting torture in the event of, in circumstances of interrogating potential or accused terrorists.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
From the New Yorker magazine of February 7th of 2017, article by Ryan, Lisa Elizizier, how President Trump could seize more power after a terrorist attack. And again, some of my musings about St. Bernard should be seen against this background. I talked to several counterterrorism experts this week, and they all believe that there will be another attack. Quote, I do believe the world faces a serious and growing terrorist threat. Evan McMullen, the former CIA officer and Republican who ran for president as an independent candidate against Trump, said. But Trump, either by ignorance or malice, is distorting the nature of that threat by targeting very well-vetted immigrants, including legal permanent residents and refugees. He simply does not have a strong national security case to make against these people, which is why it is reasonable to wonder if he has some ulterior motive for taking such extreme steps against them. Skipping down. This is the second time in a week that Trump has accused others of not understanding the threat posed by terrorism. And this after Trump claimed that terrorist incidents are unreported by our media. Beginning again. This is the second time in the week that Trump has accused others of not understanding the threat posed by terrorism. Over the weekend, he used Twitter to attack the federal judge who put a halt to Trump's immigration ban. He called James L. Robart, who was appointed by President George W. Bush and unanimously confirmed by the Senate, a so-called judge, and later added, "Just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something bad happens, blame him and court system. People pouring in. Bad," unquote. One of the questions raised by Trump's claims that the media and the courts have endangered the country is what he would do in the event of a terrorist attack. Jack Goldsmith, a former senior Justice Department official in the George W. Bush administration who helped design the post-9/11 anti-terror legal architecture, recently suggested that Trump might actually want his travel ban to be overturned. That way, in the wake of an attack, he can use the judiciary as a boogeyman and justify any new efforts to push through more extreme measures. Skipping down, quoting Goldsmith, if it is a large and grim terrorist attack, he might ask for more surveillance powers inside the U.S., including fewer restrictions on data mingling and storage and queries, more immigration control power at the border, an exception to Posse Comitatus, which prohibits the military from law enforcement in the homeland, and perhaps more immigration-related detention powers, Goldsmith wrote in an email. In the extreme scenario, Trump could ask Congress to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, which would cut off the kind of access to courts you are seeing right now for everyone or for every class of persons for which the writ is suspended. Skipping down. John Yoo, who as a lawyer for the George W. Bush administration was the fiercest defender of its most extreme post-9/11 policies, including the use of torture, recently wrote an op-ed in which he said he was alarmed by Trump's attempts to expand the powers of the executive branch. This was as if Trump had written an essay arguing that he was concerned about developers adding their names to buildings in lettering that was too large. You told me, quote, "If there is another terrorist attack, I could see Trump seeking all of the powers that the president can exercise during wartime. The domestic powers would have to be approved by Congress, such as limitations on habeas, domestic warrantless surveillance, and an Internal Security Act. We really haven't had a system like that since the Second World War or the communist cases of the 1950s. And Matt Olson, the former head of the National Counterterrorism Center. This is a win-win for Trump, Olson said. We can assume there will be another terrorist attack in the U.S. If the executive order is in place, he will point to the attack as support for the executive order and the need to expand it to other countries with bad dudes, i.e. Muslims. If the executive order has been struck down, Trump will blame judges and Democrats for the attack. And skipping down, Todd Brasale, Brasseale, the former Assistant Secretary of Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security, was also alarmed. I had a very similar discussion with a former senior intel official on this very issue before Jack's column, he told me. We both fully believe that Trump needs a boogeyman, but more importantly, he needs distraction and a blame source. In terrorists, he has his boogeyman. In his control of the prevailing press narrative via tweet, he has distraction. And in the judiciary, he has a source of blame for why his way was right from the beginning. Basile added, I am fully confident that an attack is exactly what he wants and what he needs. And if one happens, we've got people positioned now in the Democratic Party who would be perfect for Trump to point an accusing finger at. Again, that was at the core of my concerns vis-a-vis St. Bernard. We're going to conclude the program by taking a look at some history. If, in fact, there was a sarin attack in Syria, it does not look as though it was Assad. And, indeed, the analysis presented by Mr. Postol would indicate that there may not have been sarin deployed at all, although proxy warriors being employed in Syria may very well have been the authors of that event. In the past, there has been much more direct authorship of provocations by elements of CIA and other intelligence services. We're going to take a look at two brutal provocation bombings in Vietnam, roughly 10 years apart, presented in the book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James W. Douglas, copyright 2008, and published in softcover by Touchstone Books. In May of 1963, there was a bombing in Hue that was initially blamed Vietnamese Buddhists on the Diem administration, and there were attempts on the part of the U.S. to try to hang that one on the Viet Cong. It turned out that this was not a bombing either by the Viet Cong or by the Diem administration. The Diem administration was under fire at this point because they did not, basically Diem sought to reduce the U.S. profile in Vietnam. And in 10 years prior to that, roughly, in 1954, there was an attack. Actually, it was in 1953. There was an attack in Saigon, also using plastic explosives. Actually, this was on January 9th of 1952, pardon me. And both attacks appear to have been provocations, and in particular, noting how the news media were positioned to report the predetermined outcome of the May 1963 bombing. This was in Hue, and a bunch of Buddhist demonstrators have gathered outside of a government radio station to protest the government's policies toward the Buddhist population in Vietnam. Skipping down. The station director put in the call for help for the province security chief, Major Dong Sai. As Dong Sai and his security officers were approaching the area in armored cars about 50 meters away, two powerful explosions blasted the people on the veranda of the station, killing seven on the spot and fatally wounding a child. At least 15 others were injured. Major Dang Si claimed later that he thought the explosions were the beginning of a Viet Cong attack. He ordered his men to disperse the crowd with percussion grenades, crowd control weapons that were described by a U.S. Army field manual as non-lethal. However, from the moment the armored cars drove up and the percussion grenades were thrown, Major Dang Si and the South Vietnamese government were blamed for the night's casualties by Thich Trí Quang and the Buddhist movement. The Buddhist interpretation of the event was adopted quickly by the U.S. media and government. Dr. Lee Quack Cock Quinn, K-Q-U-Y-E-N, the hospital director at Wei, said after examining the victims' bodies that he had never seen such injuries. The bodies had been decapitated. He found no metal in the corpses, only holes. There were no wounds below the chest, and in his official finding, Dr. Quinn ruled that, quote, the death of the people was caused by an explosion which took place in midair, blowing off their heads and mutilating their bodies. Neither the Buddhists nor the government liked his verdict, although Dr. Quinn was a disciple of Thich Trí Quang and a government opposition leader. His finding frustrated his Buddhist friends because it tended to exonerate Diem's security police. They were apparently incapable of inflicting the kinds of wounds he described. On the other hand, the government imprisoned Dr. Quinn for refusing to sign a medical certificate it had drawn up that claimed the victim's wounds came from a type of bomb made by the Viet Cong, something Quinn didn't know and wouldn't certify. The absence of any metal in the bodies or on the radio station's veranda pointed to powerful plastic bombs as the source of the explosions. However, the Saigon government's eagerness to identify plastic bombs with its enemy, the Viet Cong, was questionable. As Ellen Hammer pointed out in her investigation of the incident, in later years, men who had served with the Viet Cong at that time denied that they had any plastic that could have produced such destruction. Who did possess such powerful plastic bombs? The answer is provided by Graham Greene's prophetic novel, The Quiet American, based on historical events that occurred in Saigon 11 years before the bombing in Hue. Greene was in Saigon on January 9, 1952, when two bombs exploded in the city's center, killing 10 and injuring many more. A picture of the scene showing a man with his legs blown off appeared in Life magazine as the picture of the week. The Life caption said the Saigon bombs had been planted by Viet Minh communists, unquote, and, quote, signaled general intensification of the Viet Minh violence. In like manner, the New York Times headlined, Red's Time Bombs Rip Saigon Center. In Saigon, Graham Greene knew the bombs had been planted and claimed proudly not by the Viet Minh, but by a warlord, General Tay, whom Greene knew. General Tay's bombing material, a U.S. plastic, had been supplied to him by his sponsor, the Central Intelligence Agency. Greene observed in his memoir, Ways of Escape, it was no coincidence that the Life photographer at the moment of the explosion was so well placed that he was able to take an astonishing and horrifying photograph which showed the body of a trishaw driver still upright after his legs had been blown off. The CIA had set the scene, alerting the Life photographer and the Times reporter so they could convey the terrorist bombing as the work of Viet Minh communists to a mass audience. Skipping down. In May of 1963, Diem's younger brother, Ngo Dinh Khan, who ruled Hue at the time, thought from the beginning that the Viet Cong had nothing to do with the explosions at the radio station. According to an investigation carried by the Catholic newspaper Hoa Binh, Ngo Dinh Khan and his advisors were, quote, convinced the explosions had to be the work of an American agent who wanted to make trouble for GM. In 1970, Waubin located such a man, a Captain Scott, who in later years became a U.S. military advisor in the Mekong Delta. Scott had come to Wei from Da Nang on May 7, 1963. He admitted he was the American agent responsible for the bombing at the radio station the next day. He said he used, quote, an explosive that was still secret and known only to certain people in the Central Intelligence Agency, a charge no larger than a matchbox with a timing device, unquote. Again, for some perspective on the history of manufacturing agents, or incidents, I should say, to justify policy directions. This concludes For the Record program number 955, Syrian Chemical Weapons Attack, Not So Fast, Part 2, being recorded on March 20th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.